The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Now, our next guest also has a very keen interest in Brexit. Chris Haskins has been a major figure in the food industry in Britain and Ireland. Originally from County Wicklow, he's the former head of Northern Foods. He's also been involved in politics, particularly after retiring from the business. He was given the moniker Rural Tsar for his role advising Tony Blair. These days, he maintains business interests and sits in the House of Lords as a Labour peer. Chris Haskins, you're very welcome to the programme. Let's talk Brexit first. There seems to have been quite a lot of positive soundings in the last couple of days and negotiations are going on. Are you optimistic that it will end up in some kind of a deal?
I've always felt there's going to be a deal. I think the consequences of no deal are too much even for Boris Johnson to think about.
As someone who has been very pro-European over many decades and someone who I presume was very much a Remainer in the debate, would you still hold out the possibility as to what you would like for a second referendum?
Well, I would like to remain, obviously, but I've come to the conclusion that there's so much bad blood between the British, particularly the English, and the rest of Europe, and so much ambivalence over the last 40 years, right from the beginning there was ambivalence when Harold Macmillan was trying to get in. Always the British have been the odd man out, and this has all come to a shining head in this debate on this referendum. So I come to the conclusion that actually, from everybody's point of view, it's less good than being in, but a soft Brexit deal is probably the most realistic opportunity we have.
As someone who has lived in England for, I think, 50 years or more, looking around and talking to people there, if there was a second referendum, if that had come about, do you think that the result would have been any different?
I think it probably would. I think it probably would be a switch from, say, 52-48 to 52-48 the other way, something like that. The trouble is that wouldn't solve the problem necessarily, because the leavers would then feel cheated, and the bad will, the tension would still go on. The only way to get the Remain thing done properly is to get 60-65% of the vote on side, which incidentally is what Cameron should have insisted on in the first instance. There'd be no change unless there was a 65% vote for leaving.
If things do progress in the coming days towards a deal which involves some kind of special arrangement for Northern Ireland and its status and relationship with the customs union or a customs partnership or some variation of that, do you think it's something that a sufficient number of Labour MPs would be willing to support, particularly after a lot of the acrimonious exchanges between Labour and Boris Johnson since he took over?
Well, that's the big question. People assume that if Boris Johnson and Leo can do a deal, that it would sail through. I think the mathematics, the statistics in the House of Commons would be still very tight, because I don't see Corbyn's and his lot voting ever on the same side as Boris Johnson. I think it still could get through, because there'd be 20 or 30 Labour MPs who would probably break ranks at that stage. But there's a long way to go before we get to that position.
You say Corbyn's lot, and you're saying that as someone who was a Tsar for Rural Affairs for Tony Blair. You've had connections with the Labour Party over quite a long period. You're not impressed with Jeremy Corbyn, I take it.
I've had connections with the Labour Party for 50 years, even though they've thrown me out twice. As far as the present Labour Party is concerned, I think Corbyn is a lovely fellow, but I think he's completely unsuitable to run this country.
One of the things, let's assume for a moment, if the near impossible happens and there is some kind of a deal which takes care of the situation regarding keeping an open border in Northern Ireland. I've been reading in the last few days some research which suggests that the Conservative Party and this government under Boris Johnson, that if they do get a deal and they begin the process of Brexit, then in actual fact what they'd like to do is, in regulatory terms, take Britain further and further away from the EU in order to gain a competitive advantage. And this is beginning to manifest itself across a number of areas. Is that something you would be fearful of? Because they really want to make this idea of Britain trading with the world and new trade deals as making Brexit work?
I think this is all fantasy stuff, and I don't think it'll happen. And one of the reasons I don't think it'll happen is people think that assuming a deal is done in the next week, that's the end of the story. It's only the beginning of the story. We then have 2 years of detailed negotiations on a trade deal between the UK and the EU. Now, my understanding is if you take the food industry, which I know very well, food and agriculture, that the leaders of the food and agriculture in the UK will not want to break away from the regulatory arrangements that exist across Europe, because they'd be immediately put at a huge disadvantage. And the idea that the Americans are going to have a special deal on food and agriculture for Britain and at the expense of our trade with the European Union is nonsense. I don't worry about that. This is the sort of unrealistic stuff that the Leavers have been peddling all the time, that somehow Donald Trump is going to come to their help and their salvation. That ain't going to happen.
Well, Chris, as somebody, you're originally from Wicklow and you've been steeped in the food industry for many years, having run Northern Foods and a number of other things as well along the way. Tell me a bit about starting off. You were born in Wicklow town.
I was. Family were a mixture of business people, merchants in Wicklow, and farmers. They'd come from Tinnahealy originally, and they'd come to Wicklow 100 years ago, and they were quite successful. My great uncle was a lawyer there. My another uncle was a grocer, and my grandfather ran a mill and a merchant, an agricultural merchant's business, which my father took over from him. And then my father always had an inkling to be a farmer, and he decided then to buy what in those days was a very large farm, Oatlands, which is 250 acres. He did it without telling my mother, who wasn't hugely pleased about it. But I was very delighted with it, because it said Oatlands was something that the original plan was that I would run it. Didn't happen in the end, but that was the original idea.
And what happened? Were you disappointed? Did you want to be a farmer when you were a kid and this farm came into the family?
I did, but I went to Trinity, and I also got interested in journalism. I did a lot of writing when I was in Trinity, both for the university magazines and for the Irish Times and for the Manchester Guardian, as it was then.
I read somewhere that the Irish Times actually did offer you a job.
They did. What happened? Because these are the days where everybody knew everybody else's business. Alec Newman, who was then the deputy editor, rang my mother and said, oh, we've changed our mind. We may have a job for Chris. And my mother, in her wisdom, didn't think there was a great idea for her son becoming a journalist, and said, no, he's fixed up with the job. Well, I wasn't at the time. I didn't hear this till about a year or two later, but it was too late by then.
Were you annoyed with her?
No. That's a that's life.
So you decided to go to... You studied history in Trinity College, perhaps an unusual educational background for someone who ends up in business and running a multi-million euro company.
Yeah, well, I also had the potential of being an academic, because in those days they used to give you marks for degrees, and you've got a first-class degree, you had 65%, and I had 64.7%, because one of the lecturers took exception to me for some reason. Oddly enough, he voted me down or wrote me down on political theory, which is rather ironic.
And when you were in England, you were still quite a young man. You ended up going over to the north in the 1960s, when things were really beginning to kick off in terms of the civil rights movement and that.
Yeah, I mean, I went in 1962, and actually, when I went in 1962, Basil Brooke was still the Prime Minister, and the Ulster Unionists were unshakable, as it were. But then Terence O'Neill succeeded Brooke, and Terence O'Neill, who was an old Etonian, very Anglo-Irish, and rather grand, saw that something had to be done, and he invited Sean Lamass to come up to the north, which was a big, big thing. And Paisley demonstrated outside Stormont against him. And I got involved politically then with the need for change in Northern Ireland. And one thing led to another. And eventually I was on the first big civil rights march into Derry in 1969, 50 years ago. Bricks were hurled at us over the heads of the RUC, who were then we didn't know at the time, the B Specials, who were seriously not on our side, put it that way. And I remember running away from all this, and as it happened, I was just being transferred back to work in England, and I left at that time. But I did go back many, many times during the Troubles, because we had businesses there. And in the great strike of 1974, I shall never forget, going, all our workers in one of the dairies went on strike, and I was sent over to try and persuade them to go back. And I stood on the table of the canteen, and as I was persuading them that it was very foolish to be going on strike, a guy at the front reached into his pocket and produced a pistol and started playing with it in his hand. So I think I was wasting my time there.
You were going to have to take a hint, I think, in that case, were you?
Exactly, yeah.
Now, your wife is originally from England, but you met her. Was she studying in Ireland when you met?
Yeah, she was doing history in Trinity as well.
And then her family background and her family's business was what became Northern Foods.
It was
Foods,
a company called Northern
company.
Dairies in Yorkshire. Basically, Yorkshire was just expanding into Belfast. That's why I went there. And it was remained Northern Dairies, just a dairy business, until I came back from Belfast, and we decided we had to broaden the base away from milk. And I had the history of it is a strange story. I was still in Belfast, getting a plane back from London to Belfast, and I was sitting beside a guy who started talking to him, and he came from Marks and Spencer. And I said, oh, what are you doing coming to Belfast? And he said, oh, we're planning to open a store. So my ears popped up. I said, okay, so why are you coming? He was a technician. Oh, he said, we can't bring chicken in from the mainland, and we're going to have to find a source of chicken. So I said, what about the dairy products? Oh, he said, we can bring them in. I said, you can't. And he didn't know. But I said, I knew a good company who could supply you. And that was where we started. And 30 years later, we were doing 30% of all their food. We invented all the sandwich business, all came from Northern Foods. The ready meals came from Northern Foods. The trifles, all of that was invented. It was in the FTSE 100, the top 100, about 60 or 70. When I left, I think it was just before I left, it was in the top 100 companies.
When you look at the food industry, and again, it comes back to thoughts about Brexit as well, and it's a factor here. People are very concerned in Ireland that a bad Brexit or a hard Brexit would be particularly damaging for Irish food exports. Do you think that is the case?
Yeah, I'm sure. Food is a very interesting product, because governments always take an interest in food. They have to, because if people run short of food, they don't tend to vote for you. So it's always very political, but the politics are very different from one country to another. Now, as it happens, Ireland's food interests are very much aligned with the rest of Europe's food interests. The UK has always been slightly different, because it's always been a big importer of food. So they've tended to not worry too much about their farmers, but the EU has propped them up. Now, Ireland is very, very dependent upon the UK markets. If Johnson and his friends were to do a deal with the Americans, which I don't think they will, by the way, but if they did, that would be a real problem for Ireland.
Looking at your own interests and connections with the Labour Party, you obviously got on well with Tony Blair.
I did, until the Iraqi war. But I still get on well with them, but we had a rather severe difference over the Iraqi war. I thought that was a foolhardy project.
Did you tell him that?
I did. I wrote to him, and he wrote to me. And but we remained friendly. But I think he's a tragic figure. Actually, I think he was potentially could have been a great, great prime minister, and he did great things in the first 4 or 5 years. But Iraq, the legacy of Iraq, he'll never get away from under it. If he was running the Labour Party now, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in now, because he'd have seen the Conservatives off. He'd have seen Johnson and May and Cameron off on this issue. But he isn't. And although he talks a great deal of sense about Europe at the moment, I'm afraid his past is something he can't get away from.
You've been across these two islands quite a bit in your life. How does that feed into your own identity? Do you see yourself as Irish? Do you see yourself as British? How do you see it?
It's strange. When I left Ireland in 1959, Ireland was a very sad country. The Catholic Church was dominating the public scene in all sorts of ways. And I came from the Protestant background, although I wasn't very active Protestant, but a minority there. We, to be fair, actually, De Valera always supported, defended the Protestant minority. But when I was at Trinity, the Archbishop of Dublin, McQuaid, banned Catholic boys and girls from going to the university. I mean, extraordinary. So, and the other point about Ireland at that time, the economy hadn't moved at all since independence in 1921 to 1959, there had been no growth at all. There were people running around, kids running around O'Connell Street in bare feet. It was a terrible... And when you went up to the north, which I did to play games, etc., you were in a different world of prosperity. So coming to England at that time was quite exciting because England was beginning to say the empire was no good and it was running it down. It was beginning to say, well, maybe we've got to think of something else. Macmillan was trying to negotiate with Europe. It was very dynamic in terms of what was being spent on educational. So it was an exciting place to come to then. Now, 50 years later, the reverse is true. Ireland is the country I'd prefer to be rooted in, and England is a country that I'm pretty dejected about, frankly. And I think the change took place. I was involved with a thing called the Culloden Committee in Dublin, which was set up to look at what was in the early 1990s, at a time when the Irish economy was in a mess. And we did a report. I didn't play much of a part in it, but I was the only non-Irish resident on it. And that Culloden Committee report had turned out historically to anticipate the turning point in the way the Irish economy and Irish society generally has changed so dramatically in the last 25 years. And Ireland is now the wonder of the world. When you talk about it, when I first came here, having an Irish passport was a real liability, and having a British passport was the thing you wanted. Now it's the other way around.
And you have five children, two of them are adopted, two of them are black children. Was that ever an issue in terms of travelling internationally?
Oh, it was. In those days, you could put your children on their mother's passport. And these five children were all on their mother's passport. And I still had my Irish passport. And I was coming through Heathrow from a holiday or something with them all. And these little black kids were waved through on their mother's passport. And I was held up because I had an Irish passport. So I said, to hell with that for a game. I'm going to. So I changed. But I'm glad to say many of my children and grandchildren have switched back to having an Irish passport.
When you say then that you're a little bit dejected about the way that you feel England has gone, is that just because of Brexit?
No, I think it's deeper than that. You see, I think the whole concept of the Union is now in question. In 5 years' time, 10 years' time, I'm pretty sure Northern Ireland will no longer be part of the United Kingdom. I'm pretty sure Scotland will no longer be part of the United Kingdom. Now, what happens to Wales is another question. So you end up with, going back to 300 years ago, there would be one country called England trying to find an identity in a modern world, feeling very resentful about the rest of the world. There's a strong element of resentment, not across the majority, in many people, but there's a strong underlying political resentment, which is manifested in the Brexiteers, who think the world owes England a living, who think the English have got a peculiar genius, peculiar to them, and somehow they're being cheated, who fear the outside world, the EU is a threat to them rather than an opportunity. And it's all a bit sad that unless some political leadership emerges in the next 4 or 5 years, then I think it's all going to end up in tears for England. I mean, very undesirable feelings have been whipped up. I have to say, they have been whipped up by the Brexiteers. There's no question about that. Even a lot of the Remainers have been a bit patronising about the Irish situation. They certainly underestimated the significance of it at the beginning, the relevance of it as to what would happen. The English record in understanding the Irish question, so-called Irish question in British politics, has been there for hundreds of years. And they still don't get it. The Irish had a sort of inferiority complex about the English, that the English had sort of appeared to be superior in so many ways. Now it's the other way around. The Irish are the ones who've, if anybody's going to patronise anybody, the Irish have been inclined to patronise the English. And they,
you sound quite pleased about that, Chris.
Well, I think it's hilarious, actually. And but the English never did really understand the Irish problem, particularly since 1912, when Carson made the case for a partition, and that partition, which we still live with 100 years later, was always going to be flawed. It was always going to be found out. And it will be found out in the next 10 years. Demographics and all sorts of other things are going to end up with, I hope, a constructive reunification of the island. It's interesting that the unionist bloc vote has changed quite a lot because of Brexit. A lot of unionists I know, sensible unionists, are saying, well, when it comes to the economics, at least, we're better off with Ireland than with the UK.
The comments...
Inconceivable 30 or 40 years ago, but that's the situation now. Whether Dublin wants to take on the liabilities that currently exist in the north of Ireland is another question.
The kind of views that you hold about the future of the UK and about Ireland north and south, they're not what we would normally associate with a peer in the House of Lords, because you are Lord Haskins. Yeah. Do you enjoy sitting in the House of Lords?
No, I'm afraid I got a bit disillusioned with that too. I'd got into it by accident. Blair put me in. I didn't want to get in because I think it's a nonsense organisation, unelected with a lot of... rather pompous people, so speaking to themselves all the time. But I have found it useful, some of the select committee work, but the House of Lords is an anachronism. It's another, it's a harmless anachronism for hundreds of years. After Brexit, I suspect it will go.
When you look back at your career, is it fair to say that you were something of a reluctant businessman, having studied history and you're interested in journalism first?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I think that the thing that I appealed to me about business when I got used to it was the competitive nature. I'm a very competitive person, and I found that the competitive bit about being better than the other dairy companies, the other food companies, was satisfactory. Very childish, but it was a motivator in the whole thing.
Chris Haskins, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.